John just said it's a good, we love the word and it's a good job because I'm going to read a lot of this morning, partly because I think it's relevant, and it feeds into what I'm going to say. But I have prepared this morning as sort of a general. So when we preach, we don't say, oh, I'm going to say this for this person because they'll appreciate that, or I'm going to say this for this because they'll appreciate that. But what I want to encourage you to do, and something that Mark encouraged us a few weeks ago, was to apply it to your own self as well. So although I might be talking quite generally, I want you to apply it to yourself, your situation, and I'm trusting and praying that God will speak to you through that. A few weeks ago, when I preached on Easter, we finished in Acts 17, and I want to start there very briefly, and we read this, Acts 17, 26. It said, "And God made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth." Claire spoke last week about humanity and went back to that creation account. And we talked about, when I spoke, that if we take that clause out, it says that God created us so that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way towards him and find him. And I gave the illustration that that's a bit like us scrabbling around in the dark. If you've ever got up in the middle of the night and things are dark, particularly if you're away, maybe on holiday, and you're not sure of your surroundings, and you're feeling around for something, or something falls off your bedside cabinet and you're feeling around, you don't want to turn the light on to wake anyone else up. That was the impression that I got from this verse, that we are feeling around and to try to find God, but he's not actually that far away. And I want to talk this morning about how we live in that world, how we live in that dark world. And so if you've taken notes, you want to write down the title for this morning, I've called it Standing Up and Standing Out in a Dark and Foreign Land. Standing Up and Standing Out in a Dark and Foreign Land. And I want to base this morning in two whole chapters. I said there was going to be a lot of Bible this morning. We're going to read nearly all of Daniel chapter 1 and Daniel chapter 3 of how people were standing up and standing out in a dark and foreign culture. So if you have a Bible and you want to turn to Daniel chapter 1, I'm going to read from there. It will be on the screen as well if you prefer to do that. So Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, the king eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both the royal family and the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in wisdom, endowed with knowledge and understanding learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, from the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them these names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. So I want to talk about living in culture and how we do that. So I found a definition, and it says that culture is the characteristics and knowledge of a particular group of people, encompassing language, religion, cuisine, social habits, music, and art. Okay, so culture is the characteristics and knowledge of a particular group of people. And here we have these four guys who have been taken out of their Jewish culture, and they've been placed in a foreign culture. So I want to introduce a little bit of what we know from these five characters that we've been introduced to so far. So we've got Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And it says in the text that Nebuchadnezzar commanded his people to round up people from nobility and royalty, and that they should be young, good-looking, skillful, wise, knowledgeable, and competent. Now, that's a good definition, good description of anyone. I'm sure we would all like to be like that. And it says they were either from the nobility or from royalty, so I'm assuming that they might have been noble people in themselves. That might have been a characteristic. They might have been rich. They might have been posh. So when I read this definition of people from royalty or definition royalty or nobility, I think of maybe people who go to Eton, people go to Oxbridge, the top people in their fields. They're very intelligent people. And so I imagine if Nebuchadnezzar was going to come and invade our country now, they would be two of the places he would have gone to. And he would have taken the cream from the top, as society thinks of. But often what comes with that is a hereditary status of culture. And people, we call them posh, don't we? And we think of them, they're well ingrained in the culture. So they've been taken from one extreme, probably the top of their culture, and they've been taken to a completely different and foreign culture by this king, Nebuchadnezzar. And we hear of Nebuchadnezzar a few times in the Bible. And I think that he's quite an evil king. He's quite a proud king, and he's quite a fickle king. So he's the king of the Babylon and the Babylonian Empire. And we read in 2 Kings and Jeremiah as well this account of another time when he besieged Israel, and the king tried to escape out of the back door of the city. And Nebuchadnezzar and his men caught him, and he and his princes, and they were really horrible to him. It says that, that Nebuchadnezzar's men killed the princes whilst they forced Nebuchadnezzar's eyes open and forced him to watch. And then what they did is they gouged his eyes out so that the last image that this king saw was of his line being destroyed. So he was quite a nasty king. History tells us as well that they would have also, at this time, he would have pulled out the king's tongue to stop him from giving any more edicts, any more decrees. He would have pulled out his tongue and put a net. Sorry, he would have pulled out his tongue and put a nail through it and nailed it to his chin so that he couldn't give any more laws and decrees. And then they would have either humiliated him even more as they took him back to the city, or put him on the back of a horse and sent him off into the wilderness to die a lonely and painful death. He wasn't a particularly nice guy to work with or to live under. And this is the darkened situation that these four guys have been placed in. Nebuchadnezzar says himself that he is a proud man. In Daniel chapter 4. And I've said he's fickle as well, because although we're looking at chapter 1 and 3 today, if you read Daniel chapter 4 and Daniel chapter 2, it almost seems as if Nebuchadnezzar is going to follow God. He's going to follow Yahweh. And he, at one point, actually, he bows down and worships Daniel because of the things that Daniel does. And we might touch upon that in a moment as well. So he's evil, he's proud, and he's fickle. These people have been transferred from one culture into another. Let's continue from verse 8. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuch said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king." Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Test your servants for 10 days. Let them be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see." So he listened to them in this matter, and he tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in the flesh than the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took their food and the wine they gave to drink and gave them only vegetables. So here we have them placed in a different culture that has come from a place where there's strict food laws. Yahweh, the God of Israel, had given them laws of what they could eat, what they couldn't eat, how they should eat it, and how they should prepare it, how it should be killed. And Daniel and his friends knew that in this foreign culture, the food of the king wouldn't have been prepared in that way. They knew that that food wasn't killed and prepared in the way that Yahweh had commanded them. And they wanted to honor the laws of Israel's God. So they said, "We're not going to eat that food. We will eat fruit and vegetables and water that we know God has created himself, God has made, and we will eat only those things. And we won't defile ourselves by the food that we put in our mouths." And because they honored God and they stuck to their beliefs and the instructions that God had given them, God honored them as well. And as we read later, these people were promoted higher and higher and higher into that foreign culture. Because they honored God, God honored them. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 11, Jesus is talking about things that defile us as well, and particularly food that we eat. And he says to the Pharisees, "It's not what you put in your mouth that defiles you, it's what comes out of your mouth." And so us in a New Testament church today, we need to realize that it's not necessarily what we consume, but it's what we give out that defiles us. And so there's many things in our culture that we might consume. We are quite a consumeristic culture, aren't we? It might not just be the food that we eat, it might be the music we listen to, the films we watch, the places we go, the people we associate with. And going to those places and watching those things, I'm going to say to you, is not actually wrong in itself. But when we consume those things and it defiles us on the inside and then we speak about those things, that's what God says to us today, that that's not what I want you to do. We are to go to places where maybe there is things that would defile the people. And we need to take on board those things, but speak out love. Martin Lloyd-Jones, he said that as Christians, we need to live with the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other hand. So we need to know what's going on. So when I was growing up, and I'm sure maybe for some of you it may have been different, maybe even worse, or maybe a bit better, depending on your opinion, but there were places where I wasn't allowed to go to. There were things that I weren't allowed to see. There were Christians I knew who would never be allowed to go to the cinema because that was an evil place to go to. There were certain types of music that people said, you can't listen to this because that's the devil's music. And I think it's Cliff Richard, wasn't it? He did a cover of a song that said, why should the devil have all the good music? Thinking about rock and roll. And someone else said, why should the devil have anything? Okay, why do we associate things with that being evil? Christians are allowed to explore in these things. And if you like rock and roll music, that's not going to defile you. If you like rap music, that's not necessarily going to defile you either. What we consume is not the problem. It's what then comes out. And if our culture, if we're consuming culture that has a negative effect on how we live, that's what defiles us. Let's carry on in verse 17. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, so that was 3 years, the chief of the eunuchs brought them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke to them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in his kingdom. And Daniel was there. So the first year of King Cyrus. Okay, so we have these four men who have been taken out of their culture, placed somewhere very different, and given another name. And as Christians, we are called to live in a different culture. We are called to live in a different way. And sometimes people call us names as well. So Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah with their Jewish names. And as they went into Babylon, they were called these slave names of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And as we read the text, we see sometimes they're called by their Israelite names, sometimes they're called by their slave names, depending on who's speaking to them or who they're speaking to. And for us, when we go into our culture, when we go into our situations, maybe people call us names. Maybe it's not the name that we're given or the identity that God has given us. I've been called, sometimes in my workplace, I'm called the priest or the vicar or a Bible basher. And most of those things, they're just given in jest. But I know that's not true for everybody. And in fact, the term Christian is likely that that was first meant as an insult. And we now claim it, don't we? And we're proud to be called Christians. But people will call us names. And we need to remember that we have an identity in God. And our identity is not going to be changed by the culture that we move into. And if we move somewhere dark and foreign, God is still God and he still calls us his son and daughter. If we live in the light, then God is still God and he calls us his son and daughter. And I know that people sometimes struggle with this thing. They struggle with the way that people speak to them and speak about them. And it's not nice, I get that. But we need to be grounded in the fact that our identity is sure. Our identity is secure in God. And if that's something that you want to go into a bit more, then I recommend the Freedom in Christ course that we run here fairly regularly. If you want to go into more of your identity, who God calls you, then I would recommend that course to you. Okay, let's go on. We're going to skip chapter 2. Otherwise, I'd just be reading all morning. And we go to chapter 3, but I do need to tell you briefly about something that happens in chapter 2. So the king has a dream, and he calls all his magicians and his counselors together in the morning after, and he says, I've had this dream in the middle of the night, and I want you to interpret it. And they say, okay, well, tell us what the dream is, and we'll tell you what it means. And he says, no, if you're worth your money, you will tell me what the dream was, and then you'll tell me the interpretation. So they've got to guess what this guy's dream is, or learn what this guy's dream is before they then give the interpretation. And obviously none of them can do it. So Nebuchadnezzar's not very happy, and he says, I'm going to get rid of all of you. You've all failed me. None of you can tell me. I'm set an execution date. I've given a job. This man's going to go round you all up, and on this day he's going to kill you all. And Daniel hears about it, and his life's on the line as well as his four friends. And he says, this isn't fair. I haven't done anything wrong. Give me a bit of time. Let me go to God, and I will find out what we can do about this. So that's exactly what he does. He goes to his three friends, and he calls a prayer meeting. And he says, let's inquire about God, what he says. And God gives him the insight and the vision. He goes back to the king, says, this is your dream, and this is what it means. And Daniel's life, and in fact, all the magicians' lives, are saved. And that dream was of a dream of a statue that had different layers and made of different things. And the head was of gold, and then there was bronze and silver and clay on all the way down. And the interpretation that Daniel gave was that the king, Nebuchadnezzar, the golden age of the Babylonian Empire, was the head. And so that's his dream in chapter 2. And then in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar builds a statue. And we often assume that it's of himself. It's made of gold, and we make that link to say that he was the golden age in the dream in chapter 2. And so he makes this golden statue of himself in chapter 3. It doesn't actually say it was of himself. It could have just been an obelisk. It could have been of one of his gods. But he makes this image anyway. And the people are supposed to bow down and worship. So chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 6 cubits and its breadth was 60 cubits and its breadth was 6 cubits. So in modern money, that's 90 feet by 9 feet or 27 meters by 3 meters. So it's quite a big statue that's been created. And he set it up on the plains of Dura. So if it's a big thing on a plain, it means everyone can see it from afar away. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the chancellors, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials from the provinces to come to the dedication of the temple of the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the temple that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. I repeated that verse. Verse 4. And the herald proclaimed aloud, you are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be immediately cast into the fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Okay, so we've got this image, and we've got all these people, all these conquered people from all around the Babylonian world, the empire, and they're told that when you hear the music, to bow down and worship. And music is powerful. I briefly spoke about it a minute ago. But I think there's reason why music is powerful. Music is designed to be worship. And we've worshiped this morning through the act of singing, or through the act of playing instruments. And music is designed to be worship. God created heaven. He created three archangels, one of whom was Lucifer, who was to lead the worship in heaven. And then this guy, Lucifer, didn't like the fact that he was leading others to something else, and he wanted to be the main center of attention. So he twisted music, and he twisted worship. He was thrown out of heaven, became Satan on walking around on the earth. But he knows that there's power in music. He knows that there's power in the sounds. So we often hear things every day, and people know there's power in music as well. So adverts, they have music in them. Films, they have music in them. And I don't know if you've ever seen any of these videos on YouTube or anything where they take the original sound score out and replace it for something comical, and it completely changes the feel of the atmosphere that the cinematographers are trying to create, because music has power. But as well, more importantly than the music having power, it's the instructions or the lyrics that go with it that have the most power. And these people were instructed that when they heard the music, they were to bow down and to worship. And although music has power and it can change and affect our moods, I suggest that it's the instructions that are behind that have the most evil consequences, or the most positive consequences, depending on how we use it. So music, I think we need to be aware that music is a tool that we can use to worship God, but it's also a tool that the devil uses to draw our attention away from God and towards himself and towards the culture of the world. Verse 8. Therefore, At that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship the image shall be sent into the fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship your golden image that you have set up. So these men would have been promoted to a really high ranking in the king's government, in his empire, and they would have seen things coming across their desk day in, day out that they probably didn't agree with. And so we got no reason to think that they stood up for those things. But this time, there comes something where they say, I cannot do this. There comes to a point where they have to stand up and they have to stand out. So all the people bow down and these three men stand still. In the presence of everybody, all their peers, all the people who they are leading, they stand up and they stand out and they stand up to the king and they say, I can't bow down and worship. And Tim Ross says that about this verse, when you stand up and everyone bows down before or in front of you, all you can see is a sea of butts. Everyone's got their butt sticking in the air. And he says that that's the truth in our Christian culture as well, that when we stand up and we stand out for Christ, people stick their butts in our face. And Mark, I know you're a Christian, but why don't you just try this? Mark, I know you say you love God, but why don't you just try that? I know you say you love God, but this isn't going to harm you. And when we stand up and we stand out for God, it's something that we have to do. People stick their butts in our way. And we have to work through those objections. And we have to sensitively and lovingly work our way through that. So we need to stand up and we need to stand out. Where do we get to? Verse 13, is it? So then Nebuchadnezzar, in a furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. And they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you're now ready, and when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, all's well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall be immediately cast into the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? They've stood up and they've stood out. I put exclamation marks at the end of those 2 points, but I couldn't at these 2 points because I'm not sure that it's something that we should always do. But here they speak up and they speak out. As I said, there's probably sometimes in their life where things went through, they probably would have been aware of the building of this statue and they let things go until it came to a time when they had to speak out and they had to stand up. And I think as Christians, we need to pick our battles when we're working in culture. Not every objection needs an answer. Not everything that comes to us needs a situation where we speak out. I don't believe that all of us need to be going out to places and saying, do this, do that, do this, change this culture. Don't get me wrong, I definitely believe some of us need to be doing that. And I think of the Ephesians 4 ministry gifts that I mentioned. There's some. So the evangelist. Evangelists are gifted at going into situations and saying, this is what the Bible says. This is what the true culture says. This is what you should do. And evangelists have a gifting for that. Same with apostles. They have a gifting of going to new places. And Jesus sent out his apostles, after his resurrection, but beforehand, he sent them out into the places he was going to go to. And he said, If they accept you, they will accept me. And Jesus went and ministered there. But he said, if they don't accept you, wipe the dust from your feet. And Jesus didn't go to those places. Jesus picked and chose where he went and who he spoke to. He never went out of his way to start an argument. He was never shy of an argument, but he never went to places where he went and antagonized people and knew that that was going to be the situation. And I think in our culture, we need to be careful that we are not getting a name where we speak out for the wrong things or in the wrong time. We need to make sure that when we speak out and when we speak up, it is done in such a way that is going to be helpful to the kingdom. Peter says in 1 Peter 3, always be prepared to give an answer. So we do need to be prepared. We need to be willing to speak up and to speak out when we're called upon. But the term of giving an answer, in another verse it says to give a defense, is when people are attacking us, when people are coming to us with their questions, when people are sticking their butts in our face, that's when we need to speak. But we don't necessarily always need to be going into culture and changing it and shaking it up just for the sake of it. I think we need to be lovingly caring for people. Yes, we need to stand up all the time, and sometimes we need to speak out. Now, as I said before, I'm not saying that we shouldn't speak up and we shouldn't speak out. And if you are an evangelist, we desperately need evangelists in the church. If you are apostolic, we definitely need apostles in our church to be doing those types of things on our behalf. But if, like me, you're not always able to do that, maybe you're a bit fearful of speaking out and challenging people, but I don't think we need to be fearful, and I don't think we need to be worried about those things, because I think as long as we're prepared and as long as we're willing to speak out when it's necessary, I think God blesses that and honors that. Okay. Chapter 3 and verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hands, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and his expression on his face changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the fiery furnace. Then these men who were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace was overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste and declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "It's true, O king." Then he answered and said, "But I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th is like the Son of God," or gods. So here we have Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego bound and thrown into the fiery furnace. And then a few moments later, the king himself declares, "I can see 4 men unbound walking around in the fiery furnace." I spoke to my brother, who's a fire officer. I said, "When you go into a burning building, what are your senses like? What's it like?" And he said, "Well, it's a bit different because we have breathing apparatus and things like that." He said, "But the first thing is, it's really hard to see and it's really hard to hear people." And so here we have 3 people thrown into a fire. And if that situation is true, it's really hard to see and it's really hard to hear people. They might not even have known where each other was when they're in that fire. They might not have known that there was a 4th person walking around in that fire with them. And I think in our culture, that's sometimes the same as well. Sometimes we can get so consumed by what's going on around us. Sometimes it's hard to see God and sometimes it's hard to hear God. But we know that he is there. When they were in the middle of that fire, there were 4 men. One of them looked like the Son of God. And I believe that was Jesus. And I believe that Jesus was there because those people needed to know that his presence was there. They had stood up. They had spoken out. They had stood firm and they had suffered the consequences for it. And they had been thrown into their fiery furnace. And I believe that when we stand up and we speak out, and when we're thrown into our fiery furnace, whether we know it or not, whether we can hear him or not, whether we can see him or not, Jesus is there for us. Jesus has already walked around that fiery furnace with us and on our behalf. And he stands there and he's encouraging us on. As that verse in Acts 17 said, we are scrabbling around in the dark, but he's not actually that far away. When we're scrabbling around and culture seems dark, Jesus isn't actually that far away. And he's there and he's calling us and he is beckoning us to follow him. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace and declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God. There we have that fickle nature again. He's switched back to worshiping God. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, prefects, governors, counselors, the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had no power over their bodies of those men. The hair of their heads were not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. The clothes that were described there, the tunics and the turbans or the hats, were that was the culture they were living in. That was the Babylonian dress. They were wearing their robes. They were wearing what they had been given as slaves. They were wearing their culture. And yet when they went in, those clothes were fine. And I think that this shows that we are to be in culture, but not be consumed with culture by what I was saying earlier. Some things in our culture are absolutely fine. We can wear the robes, we can enjoy the music, we can enjoy the food, because that's not defiling us, because if it's not coming out of us in that way. So some things in culture are fine for us as Christians to do, but there are some things that are not. And the things that were not were the things that bound them. I imagine their hands were tied tight, their feet were probably tied together, and they were maybe even tied again, and they were thrown in. It says they fell in, so they couldn't walk beforehand. But the only thing that was burned away were the straps that held them. And when we're in our culture, God doesn't want us bound. God doesn't want us to walk around with our hands cuffed together and our feet, and we're sort of shuffling around. God wants us to be free. God wants us to live unbound and to walk in the middle of our furnace with him by our side. So some things can stay, but some things have to go. I want to finish with a few questions. I said I want to apply this to ourselves. First of all, how do we stand up and stand out in this dark culture? John 13, verse 35 says, "By this, all people shall know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another." Love is the most important thing. Love speaks louder than words. That's why we don't always have to speak out, because we can demonstrate it through the way we love people. This verse I've heard a few different come up in a few different situations recently, probably because it was on my mind anyway as I was preparing this. But people were saying, when you deal with homosexuals, love is the important key. When you deal with people who are suffering from mental health, love is the key. When you're dealing with people from other races and religion who are totally oblivious or unaware or don't want to know what God is like, love is the key. Love is the thing that binds us together, not in a way that restricts, but in a way that enables us to be free. We need to love each other in the church. I was listening to a talk, Francis Chan, I think it was, and he was saying that he had a church that he planted grew from very quickly from being a home church in his front room to being a church of 5,000 people. And he said when they were a home church, a local church, they loved each other and they cared for each other. And when they grew to 5,000 people, they hardly knew each other. And he said, "I'm sure the people in my church didn't even like each other, let alone love each other." And so he stopped his church. And I think they split it up into smaller groups. And so he said, love is the important thing that we have to do. Yes, of course we want more people coming in. Yes, of course we want to see numbers and salvation. But if we haven't got love at the middle, if love is not the thing that holds us together, then we're going to fall apart and we're not going to be serving, we're not going to be ministering in the way that we should do. So if we don't love people, then how are we going to change the culture? We can stand up as much as we like, we can speak out as much as we like, but unless you have love, you are just a clanging cymbal, a resounding noise that makes no difference. And it's just a din, it's just annoying. But if you love people, people will listen and people will respond. So as we apply this to our culture, I don't mean just Gloucester, I don't mean the UK, I mean where you are. I had someone this week, a football manager, said, "I'm going back to the cultural roots of this club, that's what we're going to do." And so I think we can have micro-cultures as well. So the place you work has its own culture. The place where you fellowship, where you have your fun, maybe it's a rugby club or a football club or a bar or a pub, that has its own culture. And we can be Christians in those places and we can stand up for the culture that God has given us. But what things in culture are we consuming? Some things are good, some things can stay. But which things from your culture are you consuming and taking in? Are any of these things from culture defiling your actions? I love football. And a few months ago, I took my two little boys to a football match. And we lost. That was a bit sad. But what I was hurt by more was the fact that the language that the people around us meant that my son was hearing words that he had never heard before. And then I had to explain to him, we don't use those words. And when he did, I had to say, I know some people choose to do that, but as Christians, we don't. As a five-year-old, he had consumed culture and it was coming out of him. We need to be careful as parents. We need to be careful as Christians. We need to be careful as a church that we are taking our people, that we are treating our children with dignity and respect, and we are exposing them to culture that's not going to defile them. But we don't want to shout at them and keep them away from culture. We don't want to say, you can't go to the cinema, you can't go to football, you can't go to rugby. We need to teach them what God says. We need to teach them that God is love, and he loves the hooligan at the football match who is swearing at the referee just as much as he loves me and my little boy. So we shouldn't be afraid of culture, but we should love through culture. So what are the cultural things that you are consuming, and are any of these defiling your actions? Where are you called to stand up and stand out? These three guys, I'll use their proper names, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they were called to stand up and to stand out in the middle of Babylon. Where are you called to stand up? Maybe it's your place of work. Maybe it's at the food bank. Maybe it's here in church and serving in the kids' work, as John said earlier. Maybe it's out on the streets. Maybe it's on the bus. Where are you called? Because all of us are called to different places. What's the place that you have been called to stand up and to stand out? And do you need to speak up and to speak out? As I said, it might be something of fear in me, but in school I hear lots of things that come against me and my faith. And I don't speak out about all of them because I think I'll get an impression of someone who is always really negative, someone who doesn't want to work with people and to be with people, a goody-goody, someone who's too holy for any earthly good, if you've heard that phrase before. And I think we need to be here for earthly good. I think that's why we've been placed here. I think we've been put here on the earth so that we can do earthly good through heavenly means. And I think we need to stand up and speak out in the right places and in the right times. But we are commanded to be ready to give an answer. So are you ready? If someone sticks their butt in your face tomorrow morning, what's your answer going to be? If someone says, I know you're a Christian, but do you want to do this with me? And you know it's something that's going to defy your culture. What's your answer going to be? I suggest we think and we prepare and we consider with love what our answer is going to be. And then, is there anything that needs to be burned away? Is there anything that's constraining you? Anything that's stopping you from showing love to your community and to your culture? And we can pray that God will be with us and he will burn away those things, and he has done. I know he has done for many people here. And then finally, who is helping you to stand? These three friends, as far as we can see, they stayed friends throughout the whole of the passage and throughout the whole of Daniel, probably even further. Who is helping you? We need friends. We need family who we can stand with and stand alongside, who we can encourage, and maybe even we can speak to and say, actually, is this the most loving way of doing this? How are you doing with speaking to your colleague? How are you doing in this situation? We need that. So verse says, iron sharpens iron. And the idea is that you're scraping against each other and you're not always happy with what people are saying, but together you are being built up and you're being strengthened. And these three friends, did they agree with everything? I would be surprised, because I don't agree with everything from my friends and the people that I associate with. But yet they stayed friends together. They encouraged each other. They strengthened each other. Who are you standing with? I know a few people have been speaking about having maybe accountability groups, and some churches do that, where you get together with three or four guys and you talk to each other, you pray with each other, you keep each other accountable. How's this doing? How's that doing? What is your culture doing? What have you consumed from culture that you need to be careful you're not giving out to other people? Maybe that's something that you want to think about and to follow people in, and maybe that's something that you can do. So, who are you standing with, and what are you standing up for? Throughout all of this, we can be sure that God is standing with us, and God is standing up for us as we stand up for him. Amen.